Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we interview Carol Anderson. She's a professor of history and author, most recently, of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We'll discuss and examine structural racism in the United States. In the second half of the show, we'll speak with human rights activists that are on the U.S.-Mexico border. We'll speak with Hector Aristizabal and Isabel Garcia, part of the U.S. Border Convergence happening October 7th through 9th. We hope you'll stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On the first part of the program today, we're going to welcome back Professor Carol Anderson. Her most recent book is White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We're going to talk about structural racism in the U.S., and in particular, we'll be talking about election politics. And some of you may remember we had Carol Anderson on the program earlier this year, and we wanted to have her back on because we had so many things to talk about. But before we get into that conversation, here is my co-host, Peter Phillips, to properly introduce Carol Anderson to you. Peter?
Carol Anderson is a Samuel Cayandor Dobbs Professor of African American Studies at Emory University. She's the author of the book White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide in the United States. Carol, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter, and thank you, Mickey.
It's great to have you back on. The main theme of your book is that since 1865, in the passage of the 13th Amendment, every time African Americans have made advances towards full participation in our democracy, white reaction has fueled a deliberate and relentless rollback on their gains. Certainly the end of the Civil War, Reconstruction was greeted with black codes and the Jim Crow. The Supreme Court, 1954, Brown versus Board of Education, was met with a shutting down of public schools throughout the South. And so these kind of continued. So we were talking, we're in an election here, and one of the candidates is saying, let's make America great again. What does that say to you in terms of white rage?
Oh, it speaks to a longing, wistfulness, yearning, desire, burning passion for what they consider to be the good old days. But if you nail down what those good old days are, so you say, so when was America great? Because if you're going to be great again, you've got to ask that first question. And they come up with things like, well, 1913. And you'll look at them and you'll say, well, 1913, you know that African Americans and women couldn't vote in 1913. Oh, yeah, right. Or they'll say 1776. You mean when America still has slavery? So what I hear in Make America Great Again is a kind of nostalgia masked in terms of patriotism that is about, in fact, creating an apartheid state. It's that as they look at an America that is becoming increasingly racially and ethnically diverse, that it's to figure out how to use the levers of state, the levers of policy, the levers of government in order to cordon off access to resources to those diverse populations. That's what's behind this. Race is running through this campaign in the most open and barely coded ways.
Well, Carol Anderson, I remember when we spoke last time, you had a pretty eloquent phrase about the language that's part of dog whistle politics, right? A more coded language of racism and hierarchical language. But as you just illustrated, in the case of the Donald Trump candidacy in the Republican Party in particular, it's almost as if the dog whistle is gone.
Oh, yes. I wrote a piece that talked about that, where it was like the reason why the GOP is really angry with Trump is that he has exposed the way that white rage drives policy. He doesn't use dog whistles. In fact, he just barks. And those barks, in a really weird way, then allow his supporters to go, what? What are you talking about? So, for instance, in one of the debates, Trump said that I'm willing to use language that no one else is willing to use, and that is law and order. And we have to have stop and frisk.
And in fact, Carol Anderson, that was his response to a question from the moderator about race in America.
Yes.
I mean, that was his reaction.
Again, that is so barely coded. So how do we deal with healing the racial divide in America? We need law and order. We need to pour more police officers into black and brown communities.
That's laying it pretty bare. And you alluded to this, of course, earlier, the quote-unquote make America great again, meaning back before there were civil rights movements, back before the government was pushed to get involved in trying to create something that even resembled a remotely equal opportunity society, particularly for people of color.
Yes. I mean, so there was a recent study done that showed that it would take 228 years for African Americans to equal the wealth that whites hold. Now, begin to think about that. That's about nine generations to get to the same level of wealth that whites currently hold. But yet we have this angst coursing through the American body politic that sees their hold on the kind of economic and social hierarchy slipping. Now, begin to think through how fevered that has to be when 228 years isn't enough.
That's a yawning gap. And this is something else that's not really discussed at all. You rarely see this kind of analysis or commentary in corporate media. And the other part of this that's striking is that in Donald Trump, we don't see enough people, in my estimation, calling out this very uncoded language. And again, your example from the debate was the response to the racial divide was stop and frisk, and then used erroneous statistics on arrest rates and so forth. And the press, you'll remember, Lester Holt said it wasn't his job to fact check candidates.
Right. And so when Lester then tried to step in and go, actually, stop and frisk was found unconstitutional. No, it wasn't. But yes, it was.
Yeah.
And it was also ineffective. And that's the piece that doesn't get fully explored. So in New York, where Donald Trump's minion, Rudy Giuliani, ruled for a while and really implemented what was known as the broken windows theory of policing that led to stop and frisk, which is that hyper-policing in poorer communities, particularly black and brown communities, that overwhelmingly, disproportionately, African Americans and Latinos were stopped in rates that were so far above their proportion in the population. However, the bulk of the illegal drugs and illegal weapons were found on the handful of whites. So if this policy was really about law enforcement, you would see targeting at those populations that are yielding the greatest yield of weaponry and drugs. But instead, the targeting is going to the populations that are bringing about the least amount. So that tells you that stop and frisk is not about law enforcement. It is about the intimidation and the criminalization of the black and brown populations in the United States. And that's what Donald Trump wants. That's what Make America Great Again means to him and his supporters.
So, Carol, certainly the prison complex and the millions of people in jail disproportionately of color and the inability in many states to vote once you've been convicted of a felony is part of what you would call a kind of a continuation of Jim Crow laws. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. One of the pieces that I lay out in White Rage is how do you begin to strip the power out of the civil rights movement, particularly the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. And it was the way that Nixon led with law and order, and then Reagan really amped it up with the war on drugs. So where we stand right now is that we have 2.2 million African Americans disfranchised because of felony convictions, which is 7.7% of African American people who are eligible to vote.
And we also know, Carol Anderson, based on that, you go back in several elections, particularly the historically contentious 2000 election, where Democrats still want to blame Ralph Nader as a spoiler, which is completely fallacious in my view based on the evidence. But there were 58,000 African Americans purged from the voter rolls in South Florida.
And this is the thing that we're seeing as well. So you take felony disfranchisement and then you add to that these voter ID laws and you add to that the elimination of early voting and you add to that the purge. So here in Georgia, for instance, part of what we know is that our right to vote is our right to vote, except in Georgia, where if you haven't voted, say, in the past four elections or so, the Secretary of State begins to remove your name from the voting list. Now, it's not like you have a felony conviction. It's just that you haven't voted. So at what point did the fact that I didn't vote then strip me of the right to vote? But in Georgia, you have this massive purge of the voter list based on that erroneous and fallacious assumption. That's what's going on, the systematic way to figure out how do we roll back the citizenship rights of American citizens, the rights of American citizens to choose their own government, to choose their own representatives, because at its core, that's what disfranchisement is. They dress it up in language of voter fraud. But a while back, where it came out that Scott Walker up in Wisconsin, as they're dealing with his recall election, and emails are going back and forth, and one of the emails says, you know, it might be time, this election might be a little close, so it might be time to start the PR piece on voter fraud so we can get out that language right now. So then when we have to do a recount, the ground has already been tilled. Now, again, no evidence of voter fraud, but it is a PR piece. It is marketing. It is language to drive fear that somehow the ballot box is being tampered with.
Indeed, this is the same in Florida. You write about this in your book, White Rage. You have a chapter called How to Unelect a Black President. Rick Scott, in fact, using that same kind of Orwellian language or doublespeak about how they simply have an interest in protecting the integrity of the vote and they're protecting the ballot box in democracy by making it more difficult to commit, quote, voter fraud, right? And but we have almost no cases of voter fraud, yet we have massive evidence of election fraud.
Yes. You know, so a law professor in California did a study that from 2000 to 2014, he found 31 cases of voter fraud out of 1 billion votes. And that's B like in Carl Sagan, billions and billions. Jeez. So 31 out of 1 billion. That is the quote-unquote rampant voter fraud epidemic that has led 36 states to implement these laws that restrict access to the ballot box.
And that's an example of a dog whistle type of policy that's masked insidiously. And again, you write about Acorn, too. We'd like to talk a little bit about that. And I know Peter wants to jump back in here and talk more about some of the current election. But I would like to remind listeners that we are speaking with Professor Carol Anderson. She is at Emory University, and she is author most recently of a book titled White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We will return our conversation with Carol Anderson after this brief musical break. Stay with us. We Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with Professor Carol Anderson. Her most recent book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Before the break, we were talking about election fraud versus voter fraud. And Carol Anderson, you also write about the takedown of Acorn in your piece. Can you tie that together?
Acorn had been doing an amazing job of registering the heretofore unregistered to vote, going into communities and really working hard to bring about this kind of full engagement in the election process. That was a threat because the people that Acorn was registering were those that White Rage does not want to vote. And Acorn had a few people who didn't really want to do that hard work of going into the community and registering people to vote. And so they just forged voter registration cards. But not clever forgeries. They weren't trying to, like, get over in that way. They knew they were getting paid per voter registration. So they would fill out cards with names like Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck. But the laws require that those who are registering people to vote have to turn in all of the cards into the Board of Elections. So that's what Acorn did, but alerted the board that there are some bogus cards in there. So again, Acorn is doing what it's supposed to do. It's not saying, hey, here are all of the cards. It's alerting the state that some of these cards are bogus, but they're following the law. That became, it's not even a smoking gun, the excuse that was then used to vilify, demonize, and destroy Acorn to the point where Acorn no longer exists, but a recent poll showed that some large percentage of Trump supporters were convinced that Acorn was going to sabotage this election. That's the level of demonization that happened after the 2008 election. And so you take that, and they then used these state legislatures and these governors, then used the kind of ominous presence of Acorn as an excuse to justify the language of voter fraud and then all of these voter suppression laws. So you take something that is bogus and then you create an apparatus to do the work that you wanted to do all along but couldn't quite get away with. And you see things like in Texas. Texas knew that in over 200 counties, they only had departments of motor vehicles in 81 of them, but yet are requiring a government-issued photo ID. So if you know that you don't have access for that ID for all of your people, then it behooves you to provide that access. But that's not what Texas did. In fact, Texas's legislature, when they were drafting SB 2, they put through a rider that said, we realize that some of our citizens will have to drive 250 miles of travel to get this government-issued photo ID. So we need to reimburse them for that. And the state legislature put a mark through that saying, no, we don't. So then what you really have operating here is a poll tax. So in so many ways, what this moment has crystallized for us is how the tools of subjugation, discrimination, and racism in the Jim Crow era are now being dressed up and refined in this era and marketed as something that is supposed to protect democracy.
Carol Anderson, the polls on Donald Trump continue to be relatively close to the Democratic candidate. To what extent do you believe that's driven by white rage?
This is an unscientific poll, but I'm thinking something close to 99.999%.
Pretty close to 100%.
Yeah, and let me give you a reason why. That's not quite as facetious, but there has been work in trying to understand who are Trump supporters. And we get that narrative that these are the disaffected. These are struggling white workers who are in states where factories have shut down and it's just really hard for them. Well, a deeper dive into that has shown that, in fact, his porters make over $70,000 a year on average. Mm-hmm. And in America, that's not struggling. So all of the pieces about economic angst are not based in this kind of reality of where they are. It deals more with this fear that as African Americans and as Hispanics began to move further and deeper into their access to their rights in American society, which will mean access to resources that have been closed and walled off from them, that whites' ability to maintain their privilege, to maintain their social status, their hierarchy, will be threatened.
Indeed, we interviewed Alexander Zaitchek not long ago. His recent book is Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Trump's America, where he traveled around to several regions and basically was investigating exactly what was going on here. A fascinating read. But Carol Anderson, I wanted to also mention our 40th anniversary at Project Censored is this year. Our new book, Censored 2017, is out. And one of the things that we did in our deja vu, looking back at previously censored or underreported stories, we go back and we look historically at some key issues and see where are they now. And lo and behold, one of the stories we used was from 1977. It was a story, The Myth of Black Progress, that was looking at the gains of the civil rights era, but was simultaneously looking at there were also some setbacks and not gains. In fact, this is, of course, part of the thesis of your book is two steps forward, one step back, or one step forward, two steps back,
yes.
Right? And the update of this story, we looked at a July 2014 poll conducted by CBS, and it found that 8 in 10 polled believed that there was real progress for ending racial discrimination, and 19% of those polled said that there hadn't been. However, when that nearly 80% majority was broken down along racial lines, only 59% of Black Americans believed that real progress had been made compared to 82% of whites. And that's what's not reported.
Right. And it's because it deals as well with the kind of consistent racism that African Americans face, even in a so-called post-racial society. The difference in pay. So a recent analysis came out that showed, regardless of education, African Americans consistently earn less than whites. Another study, they held everything constant. They held education, they held the type of education, they held constant type of employment. They held everything constant and still found these massive gaps in income between blacks and whites. And the only way that the researchers could account for those sizable gaps after all of those issues of qualify are held constant was racism. And blacks know it, but when African Americans say racism, the response in American society is, there you go, just whining again, and all you've got to do is just obey the law. All you've got to do is just go to school.
All lives matter. That's the same kind of coded language.
Exactly. Exactly. And so think about this. When the killings of black people by police and the use of the cameras, I've heard it said over and over again, those images aren't for the black community. We know we're being killed. Those images are to show whites in America that you can have your hands up, be absolutely as non-threatening as you can be, and you will be shot. Now, think about how tragic that is, that to be able to experience racism to the point where it gets you killed, but nobody believes what you're saying in this society. And that's how powerful this coded language, these dog whistles are. So when Trump can say, well, the way we heal the racial divide is law and order and stop and frisk.
Certainly that is an issue that police are very concerned about. And we've seen Fraternal Order of Police, a number of police unions supporting Trump openly.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the continued militarization of the police is part of that.
Yes.
But deep inside of police unions, particularly those that were traditionally white, firefighters, police, big city jobs, was the history in the 70s of taking that into consideration under affirmative action kinds of hiring, where broad-based recruitment was done for all races, mm-hmm. to have them take tests and become qualified for jobs. The resentment that continues in white male America towards anything that smacks of affirmative action implies to them that they're being discriminated against, even though the law is quite clear that it's discrimination based on race, and it includes white people. So you think that's a major part of what we're seeing here in this election cycle?
I think it is a piece of it. I mean, it is the piece, for instance, is that it's not just in the police force. Think about Abigail Fisher in Texas, who was the young woman who wanted to go to the University of Texas, but she didn't have the grades or the standardized test scores, the SATs, to get in into the top 10% of her graduating class in order to get automatic admission. And she didn't also make the second tier. And in that second tier of admissions into UT Austin, they take race into consideration, but it's not the alpha and the omega of the consideration. And so there were like 47 additional students admitted under the second tier for UT Austin. Only 5 of those were African-American or Latina. But she claimed that though somebody, one of those 5, took her slot. The fact that there were African-Americans and Latinos who had greater GPAs and higher test scores than her who also weren't admitted was irrelevant. And so it becomes this thing where, you know, and this is why I talked about at the beginning of our program, a level of territorial exclusion to the resources in American society. So the good jobs with pensions, because that's what those police jobs are. That's what those firefighter jobs are. They're an element of middle class stability that many who are working class no longer have, because we no longer have the level of unionization that we used to have in American society. But those positions still provide that. And the same with education. Here we are, we talk about we're in a knowledge-based economy, and that access to a college education is about the surest route to have some level of economic progress in this society. By claiming a level of exclusion, what that does is to say all whites get access to the top-tier universities in the United States, and then if there's anything left over, then maybe. But we doubt it. That's what you're hearing in these ongoing, consistent battles over affirmative action, is, again, this fear of loss of access. And I talk about that in White Rage as well by really looking at the Bakke decision and how that Supreme Court said just a few years after the Civil Rights Movement that affirmative action was not about redress of prior racial discrimination. So the fact that the University of Texas did not admit African Americans regardless of their qualifications for years was irrelevant. But Amy Fisher can say, but my father went to UT Austin. I'm a legacy. I should be able to get in. That's what we're dealing with. It is to drip history from its roots so that we just kind of look in this kind of snapshot moment in time and say, aha.
We're speaking with Professor of African American Studies at Emory University. We're speaking to Carol Anderson. Her recent book is White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. And in the conclusion, in your book, Carol Anderson, you call for full voting rights for all American citizens, funding and additional resources for quality schools, policing and court systems in which racial bias is not sanctioned by law. All these are well within our grasp, you write. And again, in so-called post-racial America, we have too much of an assumption that this has already been achieved, even though you catalog quite deftly in your book, White Rage, from the post-Civil War period to the present, that in fact there is a lot more work to be done, but also that this is the kind of work that we can do. And you say this is the moment. This is the moment now when all of us, Black, White, Latino, Native American, Asian American, must step out of the shadow of white rage, deny its power, understand its unseemly goals, and refuse to be seduced by its buzzwords, dog whistles, and sophistry. This is when we choose a different future. And a fine note to end on, Carol Anderson. It was a delight to have you back on the Project Censored Show. Thanks so much for all of your very important work, and we certainly look forward to speaking with you again.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter and Mickey. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Carol.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We've just been speaking with Professor Carol Anderson, and we've been examining the structural racism that is ongoing in the United States. For the next segment of the program, we'll be talking with human rights activists on the U.S.-Mexico border, and they're part of the U.S. border convergence that's happening between October 7 and 9. We hope you'll stay tuned.
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffers, man, this ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The U.S. government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid bumping music that's abusive to the shorties. And the nonsense that you're spitting, they just listening, absorbing. I've been dormant, I've awoken, I'm a giant, I'm ready. I'm with the Apple in Oaxaca and we hold the machetes. I rock hard like palace fitting, children holding slingshots. I'm with every single kid that's down for hip hop, for the culture, the life, what it really stands for. This music is resistance, it's the voice of the poor.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. For this segment of the program, we are going to be speaking with human rights activists on the U.S.-Mexico border, and we're going to be talking about the border convergence that is happening. That's October 7 through 9. And Peter, please introduce our guest.
Hector Aristi Sabal was born in Medellin, Colombia, and he was trained as a psychologist and also was a theater artist, but was involved in the Civil War, where he was arrested and tortured at the hands of U.S.-supported military in 1989. Violence and death threats continued, and he fled Colombia in exile and is now in the United States, continuing to promote civil rights and constructive social action. Isabel Garcia, also with us today, is co-founder and chair of the Coalition for Human Rights, a grassroots organization in Tucson, Arizona, that promotes respect for human and civil rights and fights the militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border. Isabel Garcia is bringing local, state, and national and international attention to the crisis along the border, particularly the death of thousands of migrants as they cross. Welcome both, Hector and Isabel.
Thank you very much.
October 7 to 10 is a major convergence on the Mexico border. What is the purpose of that, and what are some of the key issues that we're facing? Hector, can we start with you?
Thanks so much for the opportunity to talk about this. The School of the Americas Watch has been a grassroots organization that for the last 25 years have made a call to activists from all over the country asking for the closing of the infamous School of the Americas, which was closed in 2000. We were able to provide information about many of the students of the school who had become dictators, four of them, and who had participated in massacres in South and Central America. So every year we meet there at the entrance of the School of the Americas. In 2001, it was reopened a month after it was closed and was renamed WINSEC, Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. I'm outful. But then this year, because of the issues of immigration, which are very important in the current election process, and the plight of so many people from Central and South America who are dying at our borders and facing all kinds of repression, both in their countries, which forced them to leave, as well as when they come here. So we wanted to move the vigil and the demonstration to the borders. And lots of groups from both the United States and Mexico are conveying together, and we are going to, we're planning in many, many different actions during these 3 days.
Isabel, your Council for Human Rights is down in Arizona. And we have over 400 different organizations that are converging on the border in support of these activities. What to you is the most important issue that is faced today in terms of human rights and the border?
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show, and I am just absolutely thankful to people like Hector and the SOA Watch Committee to have decided to come to the border to highlight the human rights crisis that we live here day to day, due in large part to the very policies that are being protested by SOA Watch and many of us across the country. The crisis here of death and disappearance is unprecedented. It's mind-boggling, and people in the interior of the United States either don't know about death and disappearance, or if they know about death, they've normalized it. The media has normalized it, naturalized it. Oh, yeah, it's hot out there. Not knowing that we implemented policies particular to this border to funnel all of the expected migrants from Latin America that our foreign policies are in large part causing them to leave, and funneling them through the state of Arizona. And as you know, we created a state of hate, a laboratory for everything that is anti-human. And for us, that's the most important, to highlight death, disappearance, separation, and mass incarceration here, right at this border.
That's become a political football, certainly with the Donald Trump campaign, of which he continues to talk about building walls and preventing, literally, people of color to come into the United States.
It's an outrage because there is fertile ground, fertile ears in this country, namely that we are very, very ignorant, along with other histories, you know, slavery, indigenous genocide, labor. We are wholly ignorant of the history of immigration. And so is this presidential candidate. He has absolutely no idea what he's talking about when he talks so horribly about immigrants who have come to build this country. Without immigrants, this country would not be where it is. He has no idea of the role of the U.S. government since the early 1900s, specifically to bring in Mexicanos. They have no acknowledgement of the decades of involvement, military and now more so economic, and then more military to follow, the protection of economic interest in Latin America. And the public that is appalled by the migration of so many immigrants from, you know, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico, Haiti, don't bother to acknowledge that it's the very countries that are really under our domination that are labeled the most violent and that wind up with so much migration.
So, Hector, let's go to you. And can you describe the connection then between School of the Americas, Watch, WinSec, and this border convergence, the change of location? You know, it's going along with a broadening of these issues and an expanded fight against U.S. militarization, both at home and abroad. Could you make some more connections about that, maybe historically to the present?
Yes, as I was said before, our desire is to bring awareness to the many people who ignore the role of the United States government and the role of the United States economics, mostly neoliberal policies in Latin America, which are the root causes of why people one day have to leave their loved ones, their languages, their cultures, and come to a place where sometimes they don't know anyone or they don't know the language. And then according to this candidate that has just been mentioned, Mr. Trump, they come here to rape women and to steal. When we all know that the economy of this country is based on the shoulders and the exploitation of many migrants from Latin America and other countries. So we bring awareness to this. And the way we do this is by bringing speakers who are connected to the struggles both in this country as well as in South America and Central America. And also, one of the characteristics of the SOA vigil is that we also use the arts, use giant puppets, use music, and use ritual to mourn for the deaths of the many people who have been sacrificed in Latin America by the hands of our military and therefore by the taxes that we pay the government. So we made awareness that we bring awareness to the fact that we are all responsible for this. But we also use giant puppets and other ways to create images of what we offer instead. So it's not just a protest to say no to militarism or to say no to whoever the current government is in the country. But we also create images for what we want, what we want cooperation and solidarity to look like. For example, now that we will be at the wall, the fence that divides the border, we want to transform, to create images of how to transform that wall into bridges, and bridges of cooperation and humanity, and in that way rehumanize our relationships to our brothers and sisters in the South. For example, I can talk about my personal history. I was tortured by U.S.-trained soldiers from Colombia, and this was part of the policies of the School of the Americas during the 60s and 70s, where they wanted to, quote-unquote, kill the communists. Later on, the counterinsurgency policies became counter-narcotics, and today they are counter-terrorism. So we know that many, many human rights activists in our countries have been killed. The most recent person was in Honduras. So we are bringing awareness of why these things are happening and how we all as a country are contributing with our taxes to these policies and how we can change them. We have to change them.
Hector, you fled Colombia because of violence and death threats, and many tens of thousands of people throughout Latin America have left their countries because of threats and fears for their life and repression. In Colombia now, there was just recently a vote, a negative vote on the peace treaty that had been proposed there. What do you see the future of Colombia, and why did that treaty get voted down?
I wish I had the answer. Like, I wish I had the answer why Donald Trump is a candidate to the presidency of the United States, or why Berlusconi or Putin or these characters have been elected in their countries. What we know is that we were very convinced that the sea was going to pass, and I think we underestimated the power that is still the ultra-right politicians, especially our ex-president Álvaro Uribe, who is a right-wing person and who was invited in several occasions by the current president, Santos, who used to be his minister of defense when he was the president, and by the guerrilla itself, who told him, look, you kill a lot of our brothers and sisters, you damage our guerrilla fight, but we invite you now to dialogue with us, as so many international delegates have, and so many other people, more than 60 victims who went to La Habana to talk to Las FARC. So we believe that the sophistication and the hard work that was done during the last 4 years to draft this agreement and the fact that so many international organizations have read it and supported was going to be enough to get a seat, a yes, on the referendum. However, I was speechless after I saw the results. But the next day, when I look at who has voted yes, was mostly all the areas where the war has been most felt. For example, Bojayá, where La Guerrilla had the worst massacre. They killed 74 people by throwing a bomb, a homemade bomb, into a church while fighting the paramilitary groups. In that region, 96% voted yes for the referendum, for the peace agreement, and only 4% voted no. And if you look at the rest of the country, mostly the people in the big cities that are less directly affected by the war voted for the no, voted against the agreement. So it means that the country is still very polarized. Only 37% of people came out to vote. And we still have a lot of work to do to educate those people and to listen to those people and to invite them to the table. So I'm very encouraged by the way the government and the guerrilla responded to this unexpected result. They went back to the negotiating table, and they are inviting Mr. Uribe and his group and into more negotiations. So that's a great sign. It's a big challenge. It's a big wall that we need to jump over. But I am optimistic that eventually peace will come to Colombia. And the invitation to Americans is that they support the peace process in Colombia, because for many, many years we have supported Plan Colombia, which has been mostly a military intervention in Colombia. Colombia has 7 bases that have been given to the American military to operate in Colombia in their efforts to, quote-unquote, recuperate South America, where there are so many governments who have said no to the neoliberal policies and are trying different models, like in Bolivia, Ecuador, in Brazil, for a while, and now we don't know what's going to happen, etc., etc.
We're speaking with Hector Aristizabal about U.S.-Mexico border convergence that's happening, and we're also joined by Isabel Garcia. She's the co-founder and co-chair of the Coalición de Derechos Humanos, a grassroots organization based in Tucson, Arizona, promotes respect for human and civil rights and fights the militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border. And we had mentioned a couple of names here. I just wanted to clarify for listeners, SOA, School of the Americas. You can learn more information about what we're discussing today by going to School of the Americas Watch website. That's SOAW.org. And our listeners may also know that the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, changed their name some time ago. When the going gets tough, the tough change their names. The Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, or WINSEC. That was one of the other terms that we had used earlier. And we're going to continue our conversation about the U.S.-Mexican border convergence and the awareness that we're raising around this very key and important issue after a brief musical break. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. For this part of the show, we're speaking with Hector Aristizabal and Isabel Garcia. They're part of a U.S. border convergence happening October 7 through 9. You can learn more at SOAW.org. That's the School of the Americas Watch website. And Isabel Garcia, I wanted to go to you and say this is an election year in the United States, particularly a presidential election year, and there have certainly been many racially charged statements, particularly coming from the Republicans and the Donald Trump campaign, and this notion about building a wall and these types of things, and this gross characterization of Mexicans, very racist stereotypes. This isn't even dog whistle politics. These are just open things that are being stated and seem to be going without a lot of challenge in the U.S. media. How is that affecting what's happening with you all on the border?
The border militarization was not done only by the Republicans, and I think that's why we're in the trouble we're in, because
right.
The Democrats failed to step in to challenge the lies and untruths, half-truths all along. They have refused, even our friends in Congress, have really refused to deal with the issue of root cause. Nobody wants to deal with immigration other than, well, let's seal the border and then maybe let's let people immigrate or not. That's basically the debate. We have been locked out of that debate. That's why we are where we are, because the Democrats have never challenged the fundamental lies in their premises about immigration. Our border has been militarized by every single administration. Ronald Reagan began with his big speech about how no country can be a sovereign nation if it can't control its borders. And thus we began this militaristic, more militaristic. It was already there a little bit, but we continue to feed it in every other administration as well. Enacted policies that were horrific, not only NAFTA that caused the displacement of 6 million or so subsistence workers, IRA-IRA that shut down immigration remedies to deportation, and worst of all, this horrible prevention through deterrence policies along the border. Euphemistic name aside, these are policies of death, disappearance, separation, degradation of life. We did not have death along the border and disappearances until the mid-90s after these policies. So when now we see Trump stating all of these lies about immigrants, of course, it's on fertile ground. Nobody knows anything but what the lies that are said in the media. Not even our Democrat friends can really champion appropriately. They'll talk about economic contributions that immigrants make, and all of that is really great. But they refuse to change the underlying policies that are causing migration from these countries. If they don't want to see mass migration, and believe me, it's a painful thing to see, mass migration. It's death and separation. So I think it's really incumbent on all of us to utilize the convergence, the election, and continue on to build a movement of truth. We need to tell the truth from slavery to the genocide of indigenous to the history of labor and the history of immigration. And unless we push that, we will not ever be able to build a movement powered by people and truth.
Isabel Garcia, tell us, Seward had a story about 8,000 Haitians stranded on the border. Could you tell us about that situation? Apparently, many of these people are in Tijuana.
Yes, we have a crisis with a country that the United States controls. I mean, let's make no mistake about it. And yet we let Haiti have to withstand hurricanes without preparation. And here we have a crisis in San Diego. We just met with people in San Diego about that situation. Human rights, church groups, civil rights groups coming together.
Isabel Garcia, can you continue to talk about the issue on the U.S.-Mexican border, particularly the 8,000 Haitian story?
As you know, we've had different migration flows here after NAFTA. We, you know, herded everybody through Arizona. The Central American situation has been out of control. You know, people fleeing the violence through Texas in particular. And now an increase in Haitians fleeing this desperation. And 2 days after President Obama addressed the United Nations about responsibility to help refugees, beautiful words for everybody. 2 days later, his administration issues an order indicating that Haitians are now to be removed, that the situation has improved, even though when you look at the website for tourists, it says it's a dangerous place. And so we in the United States owe Haiti so much. I am not the person to talk about history with Haiti, but there is a long historical involvement with Haiti. We should all be ashamed. And there's thousands in the San Diego area. Organizations are working day and night, private citizens working day and night to find them shelter, to find them transportation, to take them in. So I think it's really an outrage on the part of our government to continue this policy, just like the policies we're talking about here and SOA, because it's not just the School of the Americas anymore, as you know, the Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security. They work in mysterious ways. And as we saw with the decision, now there's no transparency. Now we're not to learn who has graduated from School of the Americas or WINSEC, nor do we know what's going on under Department of Homeland Security, what military involvement is going on, which has set a really dangerous precedent. Here in Tucson, here we are. We've passed 16 years of a weekly vigil. A weekly vigil where we remember those individuals dying while crossing borders. 16 years. The Border Patrol just this year, after 16 years of death, decided, oh, we're going to form a missing migrant project, which is what we have to trying to find people. Imagine getting calls from different parts of Mexico, Latin America, saying, you know, my brother, my sister crossed such and such a time. All of that is being done by private people. People don't realize that when we had an extraordinary rendition program externally during the Iraq War, little did people know we were building an extraordinary internal rendition where people are lost in the system. People are lost in the desert and disappear. In a matter of 2 weeks, your body's disappeared. You're lost in a system. And all of these are policies that come to a head here at the border exactly as they come to a head when some of these characters are hunting down our leaders. A few mornings ago, I read about another couple of students murdered down there. And so how are we going to know? How are we going to know who's committing these atrocities?
Well, we need to get the word out and draw attention to this as much as possible. The corporate media in the United States is obviously completely failing to address these issues and framing it much in the way of people like Donald Trump. And even though the Democrats, as you illustrated, Hillary Clinton, and certainly going back to her husband, Bill Clinton, presidency, mm-hmm. certainly no friend in terms of immigration issues in that party, which is a serious challenge here in the United States. And Hector Aristizabal was speaking earlier about Aleppo and Syria and really connecting the dots globally about the consequences of U.S. empire. And we think that that's a very big picture here at the Project Censored Show that we talk about a lot in our books. And I know we didn't get into Haiti too much, but, you know, on the Pacifica Network, the Flashpoints program, Kevin Pina, Dennis Bernstein, Miguel Molina, they've certainly covered that. I know our listeners should, if they don't listen, they should certainly go and check out the Flashpoints program. Isabella Garcia, Hector Aristizabal, thank you so much for the work that you're doing in the name of social justice, in the name of equality, and particularly the work you're doing with SOA Watch and on the U.S.-Mexico border. And I would also like to thank the both of you again for really connecting the dots here globally in terms of U.S. hegemony, empire, issues of racism. Thank you so much for taking time out and explaining to our listeners this very important series of issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show today. We began the program speaking with Professor Carol Anderson, examining structural racism in the U.S., and we just concluded a conversation with Hector Aristizabal and Isabel Garcia about the U.S. border convergence and global politics regarding migration and immigration issues. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We have special thanks for our producer, Anthony Fest. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. I'd also like to remind all of our listeners that Project Censored is celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. And you are invited October 21st and 22nd to the Media Freedom Summit. Come to our celebration Friday evening, October 21st at Sonoma State University with Abby Martin, Manar Mahawish, Mark Crispin Miller, David Talbot. Wonderful food and drinks. So go to projectcensored.org to learn more. We'll see you next time.
These citizens in the times when the master thief can find and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we lift our brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got that love, uplift your brothers and your sisters. The people organized can build the kind of future we want. Smash, crash, bash, bash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want to crowd loud. This pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision we want.